Blog Talk Radio. Everybody, I am so happy to be with you today, and welcome to We Uplift Radio. We are here to support and uplift and empower you, so at the end of the hour, you will feel fantastic. My name is Aricia LaFrance, and I'm a psychological marketing strategist helping people attract the clients that they love. And our show is brought to you by Whispering Energy, uplifting those whose business it is to uplift others. So I want to encourage everybody to go out and check out Whispering Energy because it really is an amazing collaboration. And today I am so lucky to be interviewing Tina McFadden, who wrote Elfolk and The Crystal Caves of Atlantis, which is an action-packed and highly imaginative fantasy adventure novel for kids who are 7 to 11 years old, but I have to add that it's a great book for anyone with an inner child, so I loved it. And her book really inspires the imagination with positive and really an empowering message. I love that because it's like kids need that. They need to feel really empowered. And it's an easy, fast-paced read. So let me tell you a little synopsis before we jump in. Thousands of years ago, on the island of Atlantis, there were signs of a coming disaster. The very first omens were the earthquakes. When an earthquake strikes the village of Elfolk, an elderly elf becomes trapped in the crystal caves. Two young elves, Enna and Nisa, must save her. But their rescue mission won't be easy. A dark magic lurks within the caves, stirring up danger at every turn and leaving nothing as it seems. Doesn't that sound fascinating? So even though the story focuses on Atlantis, the message I feel is very timely for children today because they're really growing up in the shadow of movies like 2012 and all of the end times energy that's swirling around like a black fog. So Tina, welcome. I'm so happy to have you with me today.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, great. And one of the things that I thought was so interesting that you sent me is that you started writing when you were like 6 years old, and by the time you were nine, you'd written a whole series of mystery novels. Tell us about that. That sounds pretty ambitious for a little person.
That's true. No, I've always loved to write. It's always been a passion of mine. As a toddler, I was told by my mother that I used to sit and read books. I was just sort of babbling. Sometimes the book would be turned upside down, but I would be going line by line and turning pages and obviously making up some sort of a story in my head. So I think I've always had this interest in storytelling. And so the first stories that were actually written were probably when I was about 5 or 6 years old, when I could actually hold a pencil. And the very first story that I ever, well, that I remember writing was about a family of rabbits. And I think I was really inspired by the Green Forest at the time, the cartoon. That and the Smurfs, I just love those two. And, I've always been writing. So by the time I was about nine, I had written a whole series of mystery novels about a character named Mary Burke. I was very much inspired by Nancy Drew and Trixie Belden at the time. I was an avid reader of those books. And so I wrote my own little stories about a young female detective and just absolutely loved it. Just spent as much time as I could writing, I guess when other kids were out playing sports or at the video arcade or whatever they were doing, I was at my typewriter and I had this, one of those old manual typewriters, you know, where your fingers got caught between the keys and I would sit there and type my stories. And then I think it was when I was about 9 years old, my mother came home with an electric typewriter, which was just a dream for me. You know, the keys were so much nicer, and I remember my favorite part being the backspace button where it would actually go back and white out the last letter. And then I remember spending a whole summer just on that typewriter typing out my stories and just loved it. It was never anything I had to do. My mother never said, sit down, write a story, you know, spend half an hour per day. That's just what I wanted to do. So just translated that into everything else that I do. I've always been working as a professional writer and always been writing novels on the side.
Wow, that's a fantastic story, and it actually brought back memories that I had of the first time I sat down at an electric typewriter. I had forgotten that. That backspace is really cool, isn't it?
It was just amazing at the time. It's nothing compared to today, but yeah, it was a dream at that time.
Right. Well, and did you have anything specifically that was an inspiration to you? I mean, you talk about Nancy Drew, and it's so funny when you talk about the Smurfs, because it's, you know, I think about that, and I can sort of see that reflected a little bit in Elf Folk, although I think Elf Folk is more sophisticated. But were there other inspirations that you had?
Definitely Nancy Drew and Trixie Belden growing up. But I read so much, and I have always had an interest in fantasy and adventure novels too. So, I think all of those, I was really into, Inspector Gadget at the time and, the Smurfs, as I said, and I'm trying to think of some of the other stories that I loved. Loved any stories about animals. I find that I gravitate toward adventure and fantasy type stories, whether that's in books or TV shows or movies. Just something about it really appeals to me. So I guess it's no surprise that that's what I have now written about in my novel.
Well, it's really terrific. And one of the things that I love is the idea, I'm kind of diving into the deep end now, but I just really love this, is that it's our fear that creates scary things. I mean, I think that that's so empowering for kids, and that's really one of the messages that came through so strongly for me in this story. So tell us more about that and how you came up with that.
There is definitely a law of attraction theme in the book, and it's not preachy, it's just basically part of the plot. So I wrote it that way so you can take it or leave it. It can be part of the fantasy adventure novel, and you can leave it at that, or it can be a message that you actually take with you after reading the novel, and that's what I'm hoping children will get out of it. So the idea of I knew I had wanted to incorporate the idea that our thoughts, expectations, and beliefs create our reality. So I really wove that into the plot of the story. And so what happens is, as the elves are wandering through the crystal caves on this rescue mission, they start discovering that their thoughts and expectations and beliefs are actually creating their reality. They don't realize this at first, but sort of something that they discover as they're going along. And so I think it's just a powerful message. It's something that I am always thinking about myself, and I know I need to probably even think about it more often. And I think it's a really important message for all of us to know. No matter what age you are, we need to think positively and expect the best. And I actually had a few children review the book quite in the early stages of writing this book. A few children in grades 3 and 4, and one of the girls did a little review of my book, and she really got the message. She really said, I love this book because it teaches about positive thoughts, and we need to think positively so that good things will happen, and we should try not to think about bad things. And I thought, great, this was a 10-year-old child, and she really got it. So I love that.
Yeah, I love that too. I think that that's great that she got it. And one of the things that I really like too is when they're in a cave and they say, boy, trouble just seems to find us here, after they've had all these negative thoughts. And it's like, wow, trouble just seems to find us. And they're sort of shocked. So I thought that that was kind of an interesting law of attraction kind of thoughts creates things comment to make, and I kind of got tingles at that point.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, there definitely are a few self-fulfilling prophecies in there. And I think what's interesting is the elves don't really discover what they're doing, what's happening, until quite a ways into the novel. And what kids may end up doing is actually going back and seeing all the signs, all the things that they actually created along the way with their thoughts and with their expectations. So there are little pieces and little clues along the way.
Yeah, that's what was so charming about it. I thought it was all of these little breadcrumbs. And I wanted to ask you, too, this is just a curiosity question on my part, but I really liked the green-eyed monster named Egos and the black fog of Belial. And those were ones that I was like, oh, that's so clever. But how did you choose the other names that you used in the book? Are there other little stories behind that?
The name Enna is just a name that came to me right off the bat when I started thinking about this book. And actually, I had written another novel similar to this one that wasn't published about 10 years ago. So it's been in my consciousness for a long time. But the name Enna just came to me. It just sounded very elf-like. And Nissa actually means friendly elf in a language. I can't remember now where it is. Somewhere a Northern European language, I believe it is. Yeah, and trying to think of some of the others. The other names just kind of came to me. Egos, the E-G-O-Z or Z in the States, that would be that refers to these creatures that live in the caves, who are very consumed with materialism and with things. And so the term egos is I derived that from the word ego. And then as far as Belial, that name actually I took from an Edgar Cayce book that I read. When I first started thinking about this story, I started researching Atlantis and researching the legend of Atlantis. And so, of course, I read Plato's book that mentions Atlantis, but I also read Edgar Cayce's books. And, of course, he's a famous psychic from the 30s and 40s, I believe it is, who did past life regressions. And found that people were during these past life regressions, they were actually talking about lives in Atlantis. And so he has two full books on the subject, which is just basically a compilation of these regressions. And he does mention Belial in there as being sort of a dark force or a leader of the bad side of things. So I did take that from somewhere. And I have, where possible, I've really tried to incorporate the legend of Atlantis into this story.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. See, I was thinking of when I saw Belial, the way that I was pronouncing it was Belial, like denial.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I saw as that. Yeah. Well, it's so interesting because it's like, you know, I mean, there's all of these, it's like you translated emotion into all of these different pieces. It's like emotion became animated, and really thoughts truly did become things.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
That was a huge part of the story.
And one of the things that I like too is that you talk about how the light always conquers the dark, and how empowering that is for kids. Even just one seed of positive thought can overcome and counteract a whole bunch of negative stuff.
Yes, absolutely. And there's a scene in the novel where Anna confronts this dark force, this Belial, and she's in a dark cave, which is scary to begin with. And then there's this creature in front of her, and she imagines light surrounding her because she realizes that light will overcome darkness, and darkness fades in the light. And so she's imagining this bright light, and then she looks and it's gone. Belial's gone. But that whole scene takes me back to when I was a kid. My grandmother on my mother's side was very much into different supernatural elements, and she read auras, and she was into reading crystal balls and tarot reading and all of that. And she really believed in the light and darkness. She was also a very devout Catholic. But she taught me about the light and about that light will always overcome darkness. So I remember actually having that conversation with her as a little kid at the dining room table. And so I know that some of that translated into that scene in the Elfolk novel.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. It's great that it's always fun to hear the stories behind behind the story, I guess.
Yeah.
So can you read a little passage for us? Because I think people would really like to hear that.
Sure. I can read. I'll just read the prologue, okay. The very beginning of the novel. The earth is restless, Kaya warned. Water tumbled over black rocks and seeped into the stone floor below. The cave was dim. Gail could barely see the walls around her, let alone the spirit in the waterfall. Go on, Gail prompted, spotting Kaya in the falls. You know why I'm here. An old scroll appeared suddenly in Gail's hands. She glanced down, startled, and squinted at the symbols on the scroll. What am I supposed to do with this? She asked. You know very well I can't read. I'll read it, Kaya answered, but I have to warn you, a time of great change is coming. Yes, yes, just tell it to me, Gail replied, exactly as it's written. She shut her eyes then and waited. There was a pause, and Kaya read the poem. The earth will shake, the mountains spew, a fiery molten lava stew, and watery walls will wash ashore, erasing shorelines evermore. With shrinking land come desperate men, and war and chaos happen then. But those that stay a day too long will meet their end, for right or wrong, forgotten then forevermore, somewhere beneath the ocean floor. Gail stumbled back a few steps, clutching the scroll to her chest. No, Kaya, it can't be. Our island, Atlantis, is to disappear into the sea? As if in response, the ground shook under Gail's feet. She turned towards the mouth of the cave, a frantic look on her face. But even then, she knew it was too late. The rocks were already crashing down around her. Through the dust and falling rock, Gail glimpsed a swirling black fog. Out of the fog, a tall, shadowy figure emerged. Instantly, the color drained from Gail's face. This is your fault, isn't it? She demanded. The shadowy figure leaned forward in reply, outstretched one ghostly arm, and took a long, deep bow.
Oh, I love
that really,
it.
That just sets the stage, right, for this, for the necessary rescue mission of Anna.
Well, it does.
The young elves.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, it really gives the flavor of the whole book because that's the kind of book it is. It's a page turner. You know, you just want to keep reading and keep reading. I would bring it with me when I was going to appointments and things like that, and they'd call me back, and I was like, shoot, I want to keep reading. So I wanted to get back to it as quickly as possible because every single page there's just something that pulls you along, and you just want to hear the rest.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, I know with young kids, with it, you know, kids in that age group of 7 to 11, they need a lot of action and adventure. It can take them a long time to read one page. So there has to be stuff happening on that page. And that's how I planned it, and that's how I wrote it.
Right, right. Well, and tell us, you know, we've talked a little bit about what the book does for kids because it really does empower them and put them in control of their own lives. But tell us about some of the other scenes and some of the other gifts that kids get from this book.
Well, one of the things I really wanted to do with this book was just inspire children's imaginations. And so it is very creative. It's very imaginative. It's this whole other world that I've described. So I'm hoping to inspire that imagination in other children too, because I know books had such a huge impact on me as a child. And I actually would love to just read a little quote from a 9-year-old boy that I think exemplifies what I'm trying to say here about inspiring imagination. He said, "I've played a computer game called Wizard 101, and it formed a very similar town in my head. I think the author is trying to stretch kids' imaginations so they don't spoil their brains in front of a TV. I feel hope for all the characters because they were all risking their lives for another person, which is extremely nice. I think that the characters bonded in a relationship and need for each other." So I, when I read that, I just thought, oh, that's wonderful. That's exactly what I wanted to do. I do want to stretch his imagination. Great that he said that back to me. Another wonderful example for me was I had a friend of mine read the book along with her 9-year-old daughter, and they read it separately. But this 9-year-old girl is an avid reader and writer, and she writes a lot of her own little stories. And anyway, she read my book, my elf folk book, and then shortly after she wrote her own story about a family of elves. And she actually asked me if she could use the name Enna in her story too. She was going to have an Enna character in there as well. And she had let me read the story. And I just thought, oh, that's so cute. I was so flattered that she was inspired to go off and write something herself after having read the book.
Yeah. That's great. Well, and books are so terrific for that because, you know, like the 9-year-old said, sitting in front of a TV is it's kind of brain draining. But when you're talking about a book, it really helps to inspire that creativity. And as somebody who does, you know, work in the field of psychology, I love books for kids because not only, when with yours it's great because it really empowers them, but not only that, the skills that they're going to need going forward are to be problem solvers and to be imaginative. And so books really help to spark that for kids. It's beyond literacy.
Yes, absolutely. And that was a big intention of mine when I was writing this book, is I want to be able to spark that imagination and have kids, you know, think even beyond the story. I actually created some lesson plans to go along with my book that I've distributed to teachers. And what I have is a discussion guide at the end of each chapter. And I also have an anticipation guide, which is basically just having kids anticipate what's going to happen. And I think that really helps to inspire their imagination because, well, anything could happen. And so they can kind of be coming up with their own ideas about how this story might evolve or what might happen to a certain character.
Right. Well, and you know, it sounds like the little girl who read your book and wanted to use the same name in her story, it sounds like she really related to the characters. Do you relate to the characters? I mean, do you see yourself in each one, or is there one in particular that you think, oh, this one's so much like me?
Well, it's interesting that you ask. I think any time I've ever written a novel, and I don't know if this is true of other authors, but I've always really related to the main character. So I do relate to Enna on a lot of levels, but I also really relate to the sister relationship in the book. So Elfolk is about two sisters, Enna and Nissa, that go on this adventure and this rescue mission, and they are accompanied by a cat named Mika. But the sister relationship is very close to me because I have a sister. She's 3 years younger than me. And we, of course, played together as kids and hung out a lot, and we're still very close. And so I think that that relationship that I had growing up has really translated into the relationship in the story. So, you know, the sisters get frustrated with each other. They get annoyed with each other. They each have their own little quirks. But in the end, they truly care about each other and love each other, and that's obvious when they have to rescue each other and risk their lives for each other, which happens on several occasions during this this adventure of theirs. So definitely could relate to that. I actually had a father read the book to his two daughters, who were 6 and 8 years old, and he read it as a bedtime story to them, and he said they loved it, and they were begging him to read another chapter every night. What they liked so much about it was that they could relate to the sister relationship, and I thought, that's great, because I wanted it to be real. I mean, these are fictional characters, but you want the personalities, and you want the sort of the relationships to feel real to people when they're reading it. So definitely could relate to that. I can relate to the cat in a way that I've always had cats. I grew up with cats, and then I've always had cats myself. And so my own cat, my cat named Carl, was an inspiration for Mika. Mika's quite a character. He's
Nope. I'm not sure. We may have lost Tina. Tina, are you still there? Okay, well, she'll call right back, I'm sure, so we will hear from her momentarily. I really liked Mika as well. I thought that she was the cat. I guess it was a boy, but he's just really, really wonderful. The fun character. So let's see. I'm just kind of going to the switchboard here, and we're seeing if Tina calls back. Tina, are you with us? She will be back momentarily. All right, while we're waiting, I just wanted to share a little bit about one of the things that I really liked with the story is I think it's so important. She was mentioning about the siblings, and I think that it's so important for kids to have those strong relationships with their siblings. I think that this is a terrific book for that as well. So I would encourage people that are dealing with sibling rivalry to get a copy of this book. Read it to your kids. Let them see what siblings can be like. And there is some bickering between the siblings in the book, and that's fine. But it really helps to helps kids to understand that relationship and that it's okay to have a little bit of bickering, but really being there for each other in the end. So, Tina, are you back with us? Tina, are you back with us?
Yes, I am.
There she is. You fell off of the call. I'm so sorry. So I was just telling them about the sibling piece because I feel so strongly that that relationship is so important. And as you were talking about it, I was just thinking about as I read the book, I thought it was incredible, the sibling relationship. It was so multidimensional, so real. And like you said, in the end, they were there for each other. So I think it's really a terrific book for parents to read if they have if they have kids that are fighting with each other so that they can really understand that, you know, kind of the bickering and things like that, that's okay. That happens. But really being there for each other in the end is what's important. So I wanted to thank you for that, too, because I think that it's a terrific book for siblings that are not getting along so well.
Oh, that's true. No, I agree. Absolutely. I think that when you're thrust into this situation as these sisters were, where you have to rely on each other and you have to be there for each other, well, then you do it. You just come through for the other person.
Mhm. Yeah. So now you were telling us about Carl and that Carl was the inspiration for Mika. I just loved Mika. I mean, I think that was my favorite character, and especially when he comes out of the water and it's like, Mika, I had no idea you were so thin. I love that.
Cats are mostly fur.
Yes. So tell us more about Carl and Mika.
I had so much fun writing that character. Because I've grown up with cats, and I was just trying to imagine their personality. If we could understand their thoughts, or if they could somehow speak to us, then, you know, this is how I imagine cats would be.
Yeah, and it's always fun because I have cats too, and we're always attributing things that our cats are saying. I mean, they give us a look, and it's like, you know what that look means, and we're always saying what it means, and I'm sure the cat's like, I don't have any idea what you people are talking about.
Yeah, I know. No, it's funny. I actually had somebody review the book, and she mentioned something about Mika. I'll just read it quickly here. She said,
"Yes,
I love the girls and can't wait to learn more about them in future books, but Mika stole the show for me. He was so typical for a cat. If cats could communicate with us, I believe Miss McFadden knows exactly how they would act and speak."
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, that's great.
That's great.
How I want to get it across, yeah.
Yeah, that's really, it's a fun thing. So tell us a little bit more, too. You mentioned the study guides and things like that for schools. Where can people get those? Because I think that's going to be a really, really valuable tool for basically for anybody reading the book, whether they're in school or they want to do that with their own kids.
Yes, I actually have those online.
The website is www.freelessonplansandebooks.com.
Okay.
And people can go on there and actually download the lesson plans for the book.
Terrific. And tell us where people can get the book, too, so that they know, because it's available a lot of places, isn't it?
Yes. So, if people go to my website, that's probably the best place, and then they'll be directed to Amazon, to my Amazon page. But my website is www.elfolk.com, ELFFOLK.com.
Okay, great, great. Yeah, and then people can get a hold of it. It really is just an inspiring, sweet, cute, imaginative story. And your kids, if you read it at bedtime, be prepared to read the whole thing. Because they will want you to keep going. But the thing, too, that I like about it, I think, is that I think it would inspire kids, their imagination. Reading it right before bedtime, I would imagine that they're going to have some really cool dreams to talk about in the morning.
Yeah, I agree. And I actually, somebody who had reviewed the book with his kids, he said that it was scary enough to keep them interested, but not too scary that they didn't have bad dreams. And he was really thankful for that.
Right. Yeah, there's kind of an underpinning to it that you feel, and maybe it's the grandmother, that you just feel like things are going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes. And the grandmother is very influential in both the elves' lives. She's actually the one, her and their grandfather are the ones raising the elves. And she stays with them through their rescue mission. She's not with them physically, but since the elves can communicate using mental telepathy, using thoughts, the grandmother is constantly checking in on them and sort of reading their thoughts and what's happening now and guiding them along the way. So you're right, she's sort of overseeing what they're doing, even though she can't be there with them physically.
And tell us about, because there's so many supernatural themes and spiritual themes in the book, tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, there definitely are a few supernatural elements in there. One of them is the mental telepathy, as I mentioned. The elves are able to communicate with other elves, with animals. That's how they communicate with their cat, and with the spirits as well, using just mental telepathy. Another element that's quite prevalent in the story is a sixth sense. The elves are said to have a sixth sense. So they really rely heavily on their intuition or gut instincts throughout this adventure. And their grandmother is always reminding them of that, too. Remember to listen to your intuition and that being the most important thing to them. There's mm-hmm. also a real, as we've discussed, there's a real message of belief in mind over matter. The elves believe that their thoughts and expectations and beliefs shape their reality. They believe that that's one of the teachings. I talk about some of the, quote, teachings that grandmother has passed along to the elves. And one of them is that their thoughts and expectations, et cetera, do shape their reality. So they believe this going in, and they know this, but they don't really understand, or they don't really put it together until they're in the caves and things are happening to them, and then they start to realize, hey, maybe what we're thinking about is actually creating some of this stuff that we're starting to see. So it's definitely a strong theme in the novel.
Mm-hmm. Right, and with all of the information out in the world now about law of attraction and science of mind kind of things, which really talks about that our thoughts do create our reality, because the way that I heard it described, and I really liked this, is that the eyes take in everything. It's like a camera lens. It just takes in everything that we see. But our brains can't process that much. So we create a reality, and then our brain responds to that. So if I think that most of the world is negative and that trouble always seems to find me, I'm going to look for evidence of that. My eyes are going to see everything, but my brain is only going to process the pieces of trouble so that I'm confirming that reality. If instead, though, I can shift that and I can say, there always seems to be a lot of help around, or, you know, things always seem to go my way, then I am going to look for and find evidence of that, because we can really find evidence for anything that we want to find evidence of based on what we want our reality to be.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And so definitely took that idea and incorporated it into the story. And I love it. I've always found that fascinating. I loved the book The Secret and the movie The Secret and movies like What the Bleep Do We Know? And I find that so incredible, and I do find that it works for me too. So I try to, whenever I can, I'm always trying to think positively and expect the best, and so that's how I felt, you know, I felt good about incorporating that theme into the novel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you definitely did. I got that very strongly. And I haven't seen, I don't know if there are other books out there, but I did a little bit of a search, and I have not seen really any other books for this age group that talk about law of attraction or thoughts become things. I just haven't found anything like that. I mean, there are some books in the Science of Mind Church for kids, but they're really kind of about science of mind. They're not, and it's sort of technical. This is really an adventure and really kind of putting it into kids' language and giving them so many good things with sparking their creativity and their imagination and empowering them. I mean, are there any other books out there like this? Because I haven't found them.
I'm not aware of any either. Certainly not in this in the context of a fiction novel, like a fantasy adventure like this. I know that there are, you know, more on the nonfiction side of things, trying to teach kids law of attraction. And I do actually have a wonderful friend of mine, Teresa de Grosbois. She's a children's author too, and she does teach that through children picture books. So it's for a younger group of people. But yeah, as far as a novel, a fiction novel for kids in this age group, I'm not aware of anything else along the same lines. There may be, but I don't know of it.
Mhm. Mhm. Yeah, so, you know, what I would encourage people to do, too, if you saw What the Bleep or The Secret and you liked the themes and the messages in there, and you have children that you know, children in your life, that you would like to share that message with, but it's like, you know, gosh, 9 years old, I don't want to plop them down in front of the movie because they're probably not going to get too much of it. This is a great way to communicate those same themes, that you have control over your own life, that, you know, just the smallest spark of light or positive thought can conquer all the negative, unproductive thoughts. Thoughts create things. You create your own reality. If those are themes that you want to share with a child in your life, this is the way to do it. And, you know, I would say, too, I mean, I know that it's the age group that it's meant for is kids that are between the ages of 7 and 11. But I would say, too, with younger kids, you could read the story to them. And a lot of older kids, I think, would really like it, too. I mean, I have a 20-year-old son, and I think he would absolutely adore this story. And I certainly enjoyed it. And I'm a little bit older than 11 years old, so I would just encourage anybody who has an inner child to get a hold of this book, because it's really fantastic.
Well, thank you, yes. And I've had quite a few people who've read it with their kids, and they've said the same things, that they actually got a lot out of it as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Well, and, you know, there are so many books and movies and things like that out about the supernatural right now. Harry Potter and Twilight, you know, the True Blood and Ghost Hunters. You know, there's just a lot of supernatural stuff. And The Last Airbender, I've got to go see that. I haven't seen that yet. But what I've seen is that with a lot of them, there seems to be kind of this good versus evil, kind of a lot of dark energy, a lot of just kind of scary themes. And what I liked about your book was that the message was so positive. It was really kind of, I'm going to be teaching a class soon, and we're going to talk about how it's so important that our stories are changing from this good evil duality thing to really kind of the internal, I can make a difference in the world. And I see that in your book. I mean, it's really kind of what I would call sort of cutting edge.
Oh, that's nice to hear. Thank you.
Yeah.
I do agree that there does seem to be this real spike in interest in the supernatural among people of all ages, but you see it particularly among young people. And I think there may be several reasons for that. One is that, first of all, I think it's important to say that people have always been curious about the unexplained. It takes you away from your everyday, and it's this realm where anything is possible. So I think there's always been the curiosity, but now with all this increasing technology, there are so many venues for people to be able to explore and share these curiosities. We have the internet. We have almost, you know, unlimited TV channels. We have multiplex movie theaters, and then the whole video game industry. So it seems like it's just exploded, but I think it's just that there's so many more outlets now to explore these interests. And I think another reason, too, why there is such an interest in the supernatural among young people is that people today, and young people in particular, I think, may be more open and accepting of non-traditional beliefs. We're more exposed to other people and cultures and ideas than any other generation before. So the result may be that we are actually more open-minded to new or non-traditional ideas, and supernatural may fall into that. And I think, too, that the supernatural is just, it's alluring because there is this, a notion of truth or possibility to it. There are many people who believe in something supernatural, whether it's ghosts or mental telepathy or what have you. And then there's an even broader group of people that believe there is more out there than we can see. Most of us do believe that there is, you know, we believe in something that we can't necessarily explain scientifically. And that's the definition of supernatural, is a force that cannot be explained scientifically. So I think this element of possibility is fascinating to people. Both fantasy and the supernatural really fall into this realm of imagination or dreams. For instance, in my dreams, I've had what feels like out-of-body experiences. I've flown or floated above the ground, and I've communicated my thoughts in my dreams. And there's the movie Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon from a few years back, where in the movie they're actually floating over the treetops, and as you know, when they're getting around, they're actually almost flying or floating. And I remember that for me, that really reminded me of something out of a dream that felt really familiar to me. I imagine others have experienced this as well. And so, in some respect, there's the supernatural is something we can relate to if it is something we've dreamt about or if it's something that we've imagined. So I think there are lots of reasons why it's such an interest to people right now. But definitely, it feels like you're just seeing it everywhere in all kinds of media.
Yeah, definitely. And the thing that I love, too, is that we're starting to get scientific evidence. It's amazing. I teach a class, The Psychology of the Aha Moment, and we're actually starting to be able to begin to understand how those moments of insight and enlightenment happen. And it used to be something that we thought was just completely a spiritual thing, and it is spiritual, but there is a science to that spirituality. I know that a big saying that a lot of people like within the law of attraction is, what you seek is seeking you. And that was said by Rumi, I don't even know how many hundreds of years ago. And then I was just reading in Scientific American Mind just recently that there is now documented scientific evidence that when we are looking through things, like I was talking with a friend of mine who's a graphic designer, and she has got to look through hundreds of thousands of these little clip art pieces to try and find the right one. And she said, the right one always jumps out at me. It's fantastic because it saves me so much time. And what they have found is that scientifically, things that we want or that we are attracted to look closer to us. So the picture that they had was of an apple tree, and somebody was reaching up to grab an apple, and the one that was that they wanted felt and looked like it was closer to them. So it truly is actually scientifically being revealed that what you seek is actually seeking you, or it feels that way in your mind.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, and isn't that fascinating? Because, I mean, there has always been an interest in this, and it's amazing now to be able to see that there can be some scientific evidence for it. Even with quantum physics, it shows that what we focus on is what comes into being. So, yeah, it's amazing to have science suggesting this as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. So, and that's another reason that I just really feel that your book is, you know, cutting edge, because it really does share a lot of those concepts, but in a way that kids can connect and relate to and apply, you know, in their own life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So something for everybody. Definitely. Well, I also wanted to just ask you, because we're kind of coming towards the end of our time here together, was there anything else that you wanted to share with our listeners before we wrap up today?
Well, I did want to just talk about finding your passion, because writing for me is definitely a passion. It always has been. And I think it's so important for us to do what it is that we love to do. I think there are so many people that may have kind of found something that they loved to do as a kid and then realize it's not practical enough, it's not realistic, and then they pursue some other kind of path. And that happened to me too, actually. I got caught up in that as well. So I had always loved to write. And when I was in high school, I really started focusing on the math and sciences. So I took lots of courses in math and science, and I was focusing on a university degree in science, in either biology or environmental science. And I had actually applied to three different universities in all science programs, thinking that was what was expected of me. That's what my teachers expected of me. I thought that's what my dad would want me to do. My dad's an engineer. And not that it was ever spoken or said aloud. I just sort of had these own expectations within myself. And before I actually ended up accepting any of my any of these spots at the different universities, I changed my mind, and I thought, I love to write. This is what I want to do. And I changed my major at the last moment and ended up going into a program that was all about writing. It was actually called Rhetoric and Professional Writing at the University of Waterloo in Ontario. And everything after that has always been about writing. My whole program was focused on it. And then my first job afterwards was in technical writing, which I didn't personally love, but it did give me some great writing skills. And then I moved on into marketing and was still doing a lot of marketing writing, and then moved on into journalism. And I actually went back to school for journalism and have been doing a lot of editing and writing of articles since then. So it's something I have always loved to do, and I've made a career of it. And I'm so grateful that I did that. There were probably people along the way who thought I should have done something else. It wasn't necessarily the people that I expected. I remember when I chose my program at school, a writing program, and I told my dad, he was happy for me. He said, great, if that's what you want to do. And I thought, wow, for years I had thought he wanted me to do something else, and it was just my own assumption, a wrong assumption. And so I think it's really very possible, and it's so fulfilling when you are able to follow your passion. And so I hope that if people have that, if, you know, whatever that was, if it's sort of at the back of their mind or it's what they wanted to do as a kid and then they kind of gave up that dream, that they'll think about it again because in some capacity, because I think it's just so important to feeling fulfilled.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think, too, that a lot of times what people do is they feel like if something comes so easy to them and if it's something that they truly enjoy doing, then how could it possibly be worth anything? And it's crazy because that is the big, that's like our biggest gift. It's like spirit gives that to us and says, I want to make this easy for you so that you'll actually do it because this is what the world really, really needs right now. And we go, oh no, that's too easy. So I shouldn't do that. I should do something that's difficult. And like you said, people make all sorts of assumptions about what other people think that they should do, and they don't want to disappoint other people, so they live their life based on those assumptions that aren't even true.
Absolutely, and what a mistake that is, you know. I mean, mm-hmm. Sometimes it's just as easy as talking to somebody and clearing it up or just following your own heart on something and deciding that that's the most important thing. That it, you know, other people often will come on board, especially when they realize your enthusiasm for something. They often will get on board with you. You know, not always, but oftentimes it does seem to happen.
Yeah. Yep. Well, and the fact is that even if people are saying, oh, that's silly, or you should do this, or you should do that, if it's something that you're not going to be happy with, the truth is that we tend to do those things that we enjoy doing. We tend to do them the best. So it just makes sense to follow your passion. That's what you're going to be best at.
Absolutely. That's where you have your enthusiasm and your focus and your greatest interest. So it absolutely mm-hmm. makes sense that you would do well and you would excel the most at that.
Right, right. Well, now tell us once more where people can get a hold of your book and where they can get a hold of the study guide so that people can get a hold of that.
Okay, so the book, you can purchase my book through my website. If you go to my website, it's www.elfolk.com, and that's ELFFOLK.com. The lesson plans that accompany the book are at www.freelessonplansandebooks.com, and they can be downloaded from there.
Terrific. That's great. Well, thank you so much for being with me today, Tina. It was just delightful to talk with you and hear about your book.
Oh, thank you so much, Arisia. It was just wonderful for me, too. I love chatting about writing and about this book. It was so much fun to write, and I'm loving hearing the feedback and that I'm getting as well. So it's just been a wonderful process for me.
Terrific. So it was a smart move to follow your dream.
I think so, yes.
Absolutely. Well, I want to thank you, and I want to also thank all of our listeners, whether you're listening live or by recording, and thank you to Whispering Energy for really partnering with us and just supporting us as we get this message out of all of these wonderful books and things that people are doing to uplift each other and to also uplift the planet. And I want to thank Trinity Damask, who provides the beautiful music that we start and close our show with each time. And if you want to hear more of her music, please do stop by her website, which is www.trinitydemask.com. She has two albums out, and I love them both. So I would encourage you to check those out. Next week, empathic healer Heather Hovis will be joining us to discuss the identity crisis, which is a common experience among those of us who are walking consciously. Our spirit and emotions are shifting, and we're doing a lot of work in that arena, but a lot of times the body hasn't quite caught up yet. So if you're feeling a bit out of sorts, please do join us as we work through the identity crisis. And Heather will be providing some helpful tips for us. So until next time, dear ones, go in peace and enjoy the adventure.
hoping to find my way home. I once believed in a place at the end of the rainbow, destination complete. But I know now the journey's the answer to the truth that we see. Midnight blue, though mild, worn and weathered, this suitcase of change, soft the fading denial, sweep the old. Welcome a brand new start. Midnight blue, though mild, worn and weathered, this suitcase of dreams, soft the fading denial, sweep the old.